Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Real World Ophthalmology Podcast, where we explore the latest advancements and insights for young ophthalmologists for enhanced education year-round. I'm Dr. Lisa Nijdom, the creator of Real World Ophthalmology, and I'm delighted to be joined by my incredible co-host and friend, Dr. Allison Early.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for having us. I am Allison Early. I'm a cataract and refractive surgeon at Cincinnati Eye Institute in Cincinnati, Ohio. We are so excited tonight to welcome Dr. Sarah Bozorg, who is a fellowship-trained ophthalmologist and chief of ophthalmology at the Main Eye Center, who specializes in complex anterior segment surgery, as well as Dr. Carl Stonecipher, who's a acclaimed professor at Tulane UNC and laser-defined vision and practicing ophthalmologist at the Piedmont Eye Surgical and Laser Center. All right, so welcome Dr. Bozorg and Dr. Stonecipher.
Make it easier. Welcome to call me Carl. I'm sure Sarah says the same thing, right?
Well, thank you for having us.
Yes.
Well, we're really excited to talk to you today and get your opinions on a topic I think that is near and dear to all our hearts, because we always want our patients to do great and end up 20 happy. But sometimes that's not the case. And even with our best efforts and all the latest technologies, we end up with patients that are quote unquote 20 unhappy.
All right. So you both are noteworthy ophthalmologists in the field. You have a lot of experience with managing patient expectations pre and postoperatively, both with straightforward or what should be straightforward cases, as well as the more complex ones. So if either of you would be willing to share any personal philosophies or little rules of thumb that you abide by when you're navigating these conversations that you could share with our listeners.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Sure, I can go first. Again, thank you so much for having me. I love following the Real World Ophthalmology, and I've learned so much just from all of those lectures and attending. So for me, I think it starts preoperatively. I think just going back to your basics and being very honest with patients and listening to their story and trying to figure out what they want. I think that's the hardest part. And once you start getting that idea, it's trying to match up what they want with what technology we have. And then I think it's really important to get them to understand that we don't have anything that's perfect. And I think a lot of patients come in nowadays, and cataract surgery, for example, has really become a refractive procedure. And they think, well, like my neighbor is 20/20 and can see everything. And I think it's just helping them understand that they're never going to be as good as their natural lens was, at least in my opinion, I think, and just making those expectations just more realistic. Again, I think it's simple to say, but you really have to undersell and over-deliver and really help them understand that we have this technology and these measurements, and we're going off, you know, based on this. And I actually really just tell patients lately, because I probably do like 30 or 40 cataracts a week now. And my spiel now, even though I think I deliver more than this, is I say, I'm 90% accurate at getting you where you want to be. And there's probably a 10% chance that we don't hit that target. And I think that's, we're better than that. But I like to explain to them that this, we're limited by our technology and how good our measurements are. And so once they kind of understand that it's never 100%, we might be 90%. I think our conversations just kind of open up a little bit.
So, you know, experience means you've done it wrong before. So I've done somewhere over around 43,000 cataracts. So I can't always tell you I got it right every time. But I think the biggest thing today is making sure you don't put the wrong lens in the wrong patient. So you've got to figure out, like Sarah was talking about, you know, what are their hobbies? What are their habits? You've got to make sure, I call it the 90-second workup. They get real simple things. I love the OSDI. I still use it, whether you want to use speed. I use some artificial intelligence software as well called CSIDry.com, and I'm a consultant to those guys. But for the most part, the 90-second workup is real simple. So for the first part, what I do is I want to know what their symptoms are, right? So that's my OSDI. Then I want to know what their signs are. And for me, it's simple. I look at their tear breakup time, and I look at lissamine green stain. So just to start off there, and I've taken it one step further, my staff do that now and put it in my EMR for me. So that doesn't slow me down. I think the biggest thing about Sarah's comments are absolutely 100% right. You've got to go back to that patient and say, hey, we don't have the perfect fit for anyone. We have a lot of good options. I try to narrow it down. I used to try and explain everything to every patient about every option. Now we have one of those little cue cards that they can go home and see it. We use a lot of animation to show them the specific lens choices. And we never assume. I never assume if you have money or not. So I give you an option that's all in, whatever that cost may be based on your anatomy. And then I give them what your insurance would pay for.
I think you bring up some great points. I found in my practice, which I'm about five and a half years in, and each year I've grown and I've tried new things. And one thing that I implemented probably about 3 years ago was actually sending the patients a link to a playlist of short animated videos prior to their appointment, where they can just get that visual of what a cataract is, what a lens implant is, and start priming a little bit to what some of the decisions that they'll be making at their consultation. I think that's really great to lay that foundation, and it really can go a long way to having more of a targeted conversation with the patient about what their goals are for their vision, because they have that foundation about what they're getting into already.
I love Sarah's other comment that, you know, there's always that friend that sees 20/20, and you know, they drove themselves to the cataract surgical suite, and they drove themselves from cataract surgery, and they saw 20/15 when they walked out the door, and they've never worn glasses ever since. So you always get that one.
I think it's important that, you know, when people ask, am I going to be 20/20 or I don't want to wear glasses? And I say, and I never say you're not going to wear glasses, even though I'm for certain patients, they have like a great tear film. Everything looks great. And I'm like, you're going to see 20/20 afterwards. But I, you know, you get surprised. You have a myopic outcome or a hyperopic outcome. And so even though I feel like I'm 99% sure they're going to see 20/20, I get surprised sometimes too by certain things. So I think just helping them understand that you may need glasses afterwards, even if you're going to, you know, for certain activities, even if you're getting a multifocal, you may need them in the dark reading. So having them understand that you're going to be dependent less on your glasses, but you might need them for certain things. And I just feel like a lot of times that's the truth of the matter, even though we ourselves are hoping that it's not.
I completely agree. I have the advantage right now. I'm a pre-presbyopic emmetrope, so I'm 20/20 uncorrected distance and near, but I will use myself as an example and say, I can see a little bit better with glasses. I have a small amount of astigmatism and I can see very well with no glasses, but I can see a little better with glasses. So there's some element of personal preference, tolerance, etc. And similarly with glare, right? There's some glare that is inherent to the human visual system. So I think your glare will be much less than it is now with your significant cataract, but it's possible that you'll still have a little bit of glare with LED headlights or what have you. So I think using little examples like that makes it an understandable conversation.
You know, she brought a good point. We all use kind of the animations. One of the things for me, Allison, with the glare halo thing is I got it post LASIK. So I can say from a personal experience, this is where I am. But I think that's an important point. I have animations of, you know, that are artists' renditions as pictures, but I also have photographs of artists that have shown what a halo looks like to them, or, you know, what a mild halo or starburst versus maybe what a severe is. And I think for me, that's one of the big post-ops that we hear all the time in terms of, you know, patients complaining about, you know, dysphotopsias, whether they're positive or negative.
I agree with all of you. I think it's so important what Sarah said initially with the communication is the key with patients and setting up those expectations preoperatively. I think I love the ideas of animations, and I tend to still give a lot of handouts because I've got a patient population that likes to take it home and discuss with their kids or their spouse. And they prefer to have something in hand. But I think just, you know, I think kind of keeping it real and letting patients know, just like you guys are saying, that there's no perfect technology. I tell them I'm not going to be able to take you back to being 21, right. But you know, we've got a lot of great advancements, and this is what some of the technology can do. And here are, you know, there are trade-offs with everything. So I think understanding that halos and glare do occur, can occur, assessing kind of whether they as individuals are going to be able to accept that. I think that's important. Any of my refractive surgery evaluations, and definitely my refractive cataract surgery evaluations.
Well, we're all, you know, experienced ophthalmologists at this point. And I know I'm kind of the earliest in my career here. So already, you know, there are days and patients that pop up on my schedule. And as soon as I see their name, I think of the lesson that I learned from their surgery or their case in one way or another. So can either of our experts here, do you have an anecdote or a lesson that you've learned, or maybe a specific patient situation that you really took something from, and what you learned and how that has affected how you approach similar situations now or in the future?
You know, simply put, just don't abandon a patient. So most of the patients that come to me who are unhappy, and maybe they're 20/20, but they're just 20 unhappy for whatever reason, is because the surgeon has not listened to them. And sometimes you just take 5 minutes to sit and listen to what their complaints are. Now, don't get me wrong, you got the COVID crazies that have come out, and that's a bit of a challenge. And I've actually fired a couple of patients from my practice because I won't tolerate you cussing out my staff. I won't tolerate you being mean to one of my staff members. And if you go that crazy, I just say, hey, look, here's a list of 10 ophthalmologists. Obviously, we're not who you should be. But the ones that I see that are unhappy is a lot of times the surgeon just isn't taking the time to listen to what their problem is.
It's really interesting that you bring that up, Carl. I think that's so insightful. I just gave a presentation at Hawaii and I on medical legal cases, reviewing what the case has been from OMIC with premium lenses and refractive surgery. And one of them was a co-management situation with a LASIK patient in which the patient had dryness preoperatively, had declined punctal plugs, was referred to see the surgeon anyway. The surgeon didn't evaluate for dry eyes, did the LASIK, surgery went fine. But of course, the dry eyes persisted and got worse. And the patient continued to come in and complain to the referring optometrist that he or she couldn't see well, that they had dryness. And this went on for months. And it was never communicated with the surgeon. And when it was, the surgeon saw the patient briefly and didn't have any long-term follow-up plan. I mean, there was clear that there was this breakdown in communication, and the patient felt like they were exactly like you said, that they were abandoned.
Right.
And ultimately it led to a lawsuit. And I think, I think when you look back at what prompts people to sue, that feeling of abandonment, feeling that there's hiding something about complications or maybe something that didn't go well, and lack of listening to the patient, lack of communication. Those are the three main things that that get highlighted.
Totally agree.
Yeah. I learned from one of my attendings in residency, and even if it's just delivering difficult news, you know, you have loss of vision from advanced glaucoma or something like that, I actually will turn my chair to sit next to the patient and go through that with them. And I think sitting, not opposing them, but sitting alongside them and working through it together. I remember seeing an attending doing that in training and thinking, wow, that really just completely changes the dynamic of the physician-patient conversation when you're seated next to each other, you're going through it together versus I'm just handing you something and you have to go deal with that on your own. So same type of thing with these challenging conversations with patients afterward and really being there for them. I think your body language conveys a lot of that too.
Yeah, I think that's really important. That's a really good tactic. I'll try that, sitting next to the patient a little closer. I learned something from ophthalmology off the grid with Gary Wartz and Blake Williamson that I've been using. And I recently had a patient who was 20/20, but really unhappy. And the tech came out and told me, and I remember from the podcast that they were interviewing Eric Donenfeld, and he said, you gotta, you know what that patient is upset about before you step in the room, and you're not like researching. So you got to know, and you go into the room and you just say, you know, I know why you're here. And in fact, if I were in your position, I would be just as upset as you. So I think like the patient just wants to hear that you understand, even though they're 20/20 and like, kind of like in the back of my head, I'm like, why are you upset? But you kind of have to realize why they're upset, because most of the time they're upset for a good reason. And for this particular patient, she was, of course, a minus 250, minus three prior to surgery. And I thought I had spent a lot of time explaining, but I obviously hadn't. And so I kind of sat with her and said, you know why you're upset. I would be upset too if I lost this. And I think she kind of, you know, stepped back a little bit because she was really angry. Yeah. And I kind of said, we will get you to where you are, and these are your options again. And I said, I'm happy to go in and we can exchange that lens. And I think that kind of like diffused her a little bit, because she's like, well, would I want to be, you know, I kind of like my Plano, but if you kind of give them that option. And I said, or we can try contacts, we can try glasses, but we can get you to where you want to be. And these are the risks of doing so. And I think she kind of said, okay, well, there are options, I'm not stuck with this. And she ended up deciding she just wants to wear glasses for the near. But I think if you can really listen and figure out why they're upset, because usually there's a good reason, and give them options and say, I'm here for you, we will figure this out together. So I started using that method that I learned on that show.
Yeah, for the young ophthalmologist, those two pearls are huge. First, you know, you always find yourself staring at the screen of your computer. Take the time to turn around, let, you know, if you can afford a scribe, have a scribe. But I'm just like you, Allison and Sarah. I basically have Chelsea or Haley or whoever, before I walk in the room a lot of time, they're like, okay, wait a second, this is the problem. Yeah. You know, go in there knowing that before you get in there. Now, obviously a new cataract patient or something, maybe they'll tell me they love to play the organ and they do something really different, you know, as a habit or a hobby. But for the most part, that challenging patient, if you know before you walk in the room and you've not got your hair, you know, buried in a chart or your head buried in the EMR, I think it's huge. Mm-hmm.
Sarah, I would love to hear from you, because you have built yourself quite a practice in complex anterior segment and secondary IOLs. And I'm sure there are many patients who you were not the primary surgeon. So mm-hmm. Do you have any pearls or techniques on how you, you know, explain what it is that needs to happen if they've had a dislocated lens or something, and make sure that the patient understands it's not necessarily something that went, quote, wrong with the initial surgery? Or how do you explain to these patients who are needing a second and oftentimes quite complex procedure what's going on?
Yeah, I think I usually get two populations of patients. Either it's, you know, someone much older who had a dislocated lens after cataract surgery years ago. And so that's one set. And then we do get a lot of, we're pretty much the referral base for anyone who's dropped a nucleus or left a patient aphakic. And so they come in, and a lot of times if they've had a really strong relationship with their ophthalmologist, they kind of understand what's been going on. But if they've been with an optometrist for a while and just know this ophthalmologist briefly, they often are a little bit angry with their ophthalmologist. And I kind of go over and say, you know, your ophthalmologist did an amazing job referring you to us within this week. You know, some people could have waited on this, or like try to get them to understand that everything looks like it went the way it should go. And sometimes this happens, and it happens to me and it happens to all of us here. And the fact that they called me and referred you right away is, you know, really important. And so I want them to make sure they understand that their ophthalmologist, just by calling and referring, did an A+ job. And then we kind of just go over what we need to do to get them seeing better. And I, you know, have them understand that it's a little different than cataract surgery now, if we have to do a secondary lens, and a little bit longer process, but because their retina is looking good and their cornea is looking good, we will eventually get them to where they want to be.
I was just going to say that I think, two things. What you said about telling the patient that that there are options and that there are ways that you're going to get them through this, I think that's so important to communicate. Because ultimately, you know, when you put yourselves in the patient's shoes, that's what I want someone to tell me, that they're going to be there with me through this journey, you know, whatever happened. Because truthfully, most complications can be managed. And if you're putting in these kinds of lenses, you should have a way to be able to do an IOL exchange or be able to offer patients these different options, be it laser vision correction afterwards or whatnot. And I think the other point I wanted to make was what Carl said earlier, because there's pretty good data now that shows that dissatisfaction with presbyopia correcting lenses, most often caused by dry eye, which Carl was talking mm-hmm. about, and residual refractive error. And interestingly enough, and I'm the chief medical advisor for TruCara, but there's an independent study showing that tear osmolarity, independent of slit lamp findings, if there's high osmolarity, that patients are 7 times more likely to be dissatisfied with their cataract surgery, regardless of whether the refractive outcome is hit. And so I think when you're talking about those 20/20 patients who are still telling you that things are not right, or they're not seeing quite as well as they want to, I think in addition to the communication part, which is so important, we really have to make sure that we're knocking out these other common causes of dissatisfaction with cataract patients.
Yeah, and to Lisa's point, to bundle that, it's real simple. The top three are dry eyes, missed refractive error, and really missed epiretinal membrane. And, you know, refractive error left over, you and I can say there's options available to that. You miss a dry eye, most of the patients look at you and say, you know, that was kind of a big deal. Epiretinal membranes, people don't realize, occur in about 10 to 15%, depending on whose study you look at. Whether they're visually significant or not, you know, can be a point up to the retina individual who's consulting with you. And I have I'm blessed with 6 great retinologists who I refer to regularly before surgery so that the patient realizes it's their problem. That's a classic Donenfeld line. Make sure that they know it before surgery so it's not your problem, it's their problem. And medical legally, I mean, Lisa, you'll tell them the other thing to say is never denigrate another surgeon. I just think that you can never win with that. And I've had the unfortunate not pleasure of being an expert witness where there were 2 surgeons in a town and they were obviously just making up stuff to get lawsuits against each other. And they all ended up in medical legal malpractice. And you definitely don't want that in the end.
I think that's a really great point to make. I was actually just having that conversation yesterday with one of my younger colleagues who was telling me about a tough case that he had last week and, you know, an intumescent cataract, and everything went really well. But he said, gosh, you know, my Rexis just kept wanting to run out. So I kept having to do the little maneuver, and it's not going to look very good afterward. But, you know, the patient's 20/20 the next day. And I said, amazing job. And I think that's such a good reminder that just when you see somebody who maybe had surgery with another surgeon or 10 years ago or something, and you're like, you know, that's a terrible looking Rexis, yeah. But you weren't there during the surgery. You don't know what the cataract looked like, whether there were 4 people holding the patient down to keep them steady. Yeah. You know, I remember Stephen Dell saying that at a meeting last year, just keep in mind that you weren't there during the original surgery. Well, with your
Stephen Dell and I trained together at Tulane, so we were both holding each other's patients down at charity on many occasions.
So funny. Yeah, these are all such great points. Well, I would love to ask you, because you are so prolific in our field and so technology forward, how do you explain to patients when you are suggesting a new technology to them or something that you haven't had a lot of experience with yourself? How do you share with them what you expect or why you think they're a good candidate for something that is newer in the field?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, fortunately, some of the times I've had the opportunity to be part of the clinical trials, but many times I've had friends who are part of the clinical trials. So I've kind of gotten a little intel on the technology before, but at the same time, you know, there may be a new technology that I don't want to recommend. And I tell them why when they bring that to me as well. But I think, you know, again, technology's in the eyes of the beholder. So I can still remember one of my veteran ophthalmologists. I'm going through all the different types of lenses and, you know, what they do and how they do it. And he looked at me and he said, "Carl, come in here." And I said, "You know, I'm seeing a patient, Dr. Ralston." He said, "No, you come in here now." So I walk in, he shuts his door and he says, "I want you to do me a favor." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You go in there and you tell them this is what you're going to do and this is why you're going to do it." He said, "The reason that patient came here was because they wanted your opinion. They want to hear about 20 different, you know, types of lenses and such. So if it's a brand new technology, I'm very upfront about that because I'm the person that I'm always changing my lenses." I was laughing at you guys making the comments. When I come back from a meeting, my staff won't let me change more than one thing at a time. So they literally will, if I'll say, "I'm going to do that." "No, you get one. That's it. One, you're done." And so I will always be changing my lenses. And I say that to patients. I say, "Hey, look, you know, you're having cataract surgery now, but it's not like a tumor. It doesn't have to come out because 6 months from now, I'm going to have a new lens and I'm going to be using that new lens." Now, I'm fortunate that I get to go all over the world and speak and see some of the stuff before it gets to us. But I highly recommend to young surgeons, look at what the ESCRS is saying. Look to see what the Australian Society for Cataract and Refractive Surgery is saying, because 9 times out of 10, they get to see the technology before us. And some of it doesn't make it to our borders for that reason. But simply put, you're the doctor, you're making a suggestion. You say, "Hey, it's a simple line. I use it all the time. If you're my mother, my brother, my father, my sister, all of who I've operated on, I don't have a sister, but I've operated on female cousins. I say, this is what I would do in you. And if you mean it, then you're going to feel comfortable recommending whatever it is."
Sarah, do you have any final words before we wrap up of comments, especially for the young ophthalmologists out there? This has been such a rich discussion with so many pearls and resources. I love what Carl just said. I have started, I've actually became a member of ESCRS and started attending that meeting for that very point. So I think these are such key things to learn early.
Yeah, I definitely, I love what Carl just said too. Something that I'll look into also. But yeah, I think the main things I'd say is just listening to your patients and just being honest with what you have. And I think if you're truthful, you can't really, it's hard to go wrong with that. And also thank you again for having this conversation with us. It was great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's awesome.
Thank you so much, Sarah and Carl, for being our guests of honor today. I know I, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners, have learned a ton, so many great pearls here as we all continue our practices. Thank you so much again for your time and all of your insights.
We really appreciate it, and we invite all of our listeners to become a part of Real World Ophthalmology. It's easy. Head over to realworldophthalmology.com. It's free, created and run by physicians for physicians. And once you're a member, we'll send you exclusive invitations to all our in-person events and give you access to our incredible meetings where we have speakers just like Dr. Stonecipher, Dr. Early, and Dr. Bozark. We invite all of you to head over to realworldophthalmology.com to join us. It's free, created, and run by physicians for physicians. Once you're a member, we'll send you exclusive invites to all of our in-person events and access to our virtual meetings where we have incredible speakers like you've just heard here. So many valuable pearls from Carl, Sarah, and Allison. If you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it and join us at our next meeting on Saturday, April 27th. Thank you. Thank you so much, our guests, my incredible co-host, and we will see you all soon.